to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Chester Allen, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Chester a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Chester Allen about fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Chester, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're going to give away tonight. For our drawings tonight, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight for our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Chester's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea-Run Cutthroat Trout, courtesy of Stackpole Books. You can find out more about what Stackpole has to offer at www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win Chester's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea-Run Cutthroat Trout. So good luck with that. Well, tonight our guest is Chester Allen. Chester has been a fly angler since childhood. He fell in love with sea-run cutthroat fishing when he moved to Olympia, Washington in 1996 to join the staff of the Olympian newspaper. Olympia, located at the southern end of Puget Sound, is ground zero for some of the best sea-run cutthroat trout fishing on the planet. Most of this fishing is in the salt water of Puget Sound. He eventually managed to become the paper's outdoor columnist, a position he held from 2001 to 2010. Chester is now executive editor of Sports Car Market Magazine, which is based in Portland, Oregon. A graduate of the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, Chester has worked for Northwest newspapers and magazines for more than 20 years. He still makes the short run to Puget Sound several times a month to pester the sea-run cutthroat trout. He loves to explore Puget Sound's world-class cutthroat fishing. Chester also loves fly fishing for smallmouth bass on the Columbia River and fly fishing for trout in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Yellowstone National Park. Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea-Run Cutthroat Trout, was published in 2012 by Stackpole Books. He is now working on a second book, which will explore the odd corners and often weird tactics in fly waters throughout the Northwest and Rocky Mountains. Well, Chester, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's great to be here.
Well, good. Good to have you. We've got a bunch of questions tonight, and we did cover kind of the Olympia Peninsula a while back, but we kind of did an overview. We didn't really target, the sea-run cutthroats per se. The
Well, the Olympic Peninsula is a one part of C1 Cutthroat in the Puget Sound area. Everyone calls it the peninsula, and the Hood Canal, which is part of Puget Sound, is on the east side of the peninsula. And then there's a lot of rivers that get C1 Cutthroat trout throughout the peninsula. But a lot of Puget Sound is, you know, stretches from the Olympic Peninsula, you know, right across to the, you know, basically to the Seattle and north to Vancouver, BC, and it's just a huge body of water. There's over 2,500 miles of shoreline, so it's a big place.
Yeah, it sure is. The gentleman we did a show with back in November of this year, his name was Doug Rose, and I just want to do a shout-out because there's probably other people here that heard that show or were interested in Northwest, but I found out just recently that Doug Rose passed away since November, so that's kind of a sad note, but just because so many people will be listening on the Northwest, I just wanted to throw that in there and let people know that he's no longer with us. So,
Doug is a good friend of mine.
Yeah, you knew him. Okay, good.
Yeah, he was a really good friend of mine. I went to we had a memorial service for him up near Port Townsend, near a beach that he liked to fish a lot. And, you know, I hope everyone still buys his books and everything like that. You know, the small amount of money you pay for a Doug Rose book is brings you a lot of value in terms of fishing knowledge and enjoyment.
Yeah, very nice man. We did a great interview. So, folks, if you want to listen to that interview, it'd be a nice one to coincide with tonight's interview. And that's in our archive. You can just look up Doug Rose or Olympic Peninsula. You'll find it there. But, yeah, sad to hear that. And So let's get back to what Doug loves so much to do. And I know he's probably listening in. So
I hope so.
So now, yeah. So Chester, when did you first get started and interested in sea run cutthroats? How did that all happen?
Well, I had fished a little bit of sea run cutthroat here in Oregon while I was going to the University of Oregon, and this would be in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and I would fish them out on the local rivers that flow into the coast. Wherever in the Pacific Northwest, if a river has access to salt water and it has salmon, there's no doubt there are also sea run cutthroat in the river. There might not be a lot of them, but you'll find them. And my first experience was actually on the beach where a small creek had been raining and the creek had broken through the dam of sand and it was flowing right into the ocean. And I was getting ready to go surfing and I was walking along the beach and this kid is lugging two big sea run cutthroat on a chain stringer up off the beach. It was just almost jarring to see, you know, trout being caught on a sandy beach. And I ran back to the truck and I threw my surfboard back in and got my fly rod out and went back down and tied on, I think, a woolly bugger and was casting into the deep corners and I caught a couple sea runs myself. And that was my first experience. After a few years later, I found myself working in Olympia, Washington, which is the southern end of Puget Sound. And Puget Sound is probably the best sea run cutthroat area in the world, mostly because it's a huge body of water that is salt water and it has a lot of streams feeding it. And it also has a lot of habitat for sea run cutthroat. And best of all, in the late 1980s, I think it was 1989, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission made killing cutthroat in salt water against the law. You can't kill them, if you got to let them go. So you have this huge, rich fishery that gets better every year because you're not killing any of these, and they're all wild fish. You're not killing any of them. So there's more every year, and they get bigger every year.
So Puget Sound is on the east side of the Olympic Peninsula.
Right.
And then, of course, the water surrounds the peninsula on three sides. You said that area, Puget Sound, is one of the prime areas. What about the northern coast and the west coast? Is there less activity, or is it the same, or less rivers?
Well, on the West Coast, there's sea run cutthroat. There's just not as many, and it's much harder to fish for them because the Northwest Coast has a lot of heavy seas. We're pretty close to the Gulf of Alaska. We got a lot of storm waves coming down onto our exposed coast. Now, there's the Straits of San Juan, which separate the northern tip of Olympic Peninsula in Washington from Vancouver Island. And that is a very good place to fish for sea run cutthroat. And that's basically like a channel that feeds across the north part of the peninsula and then drops down into Puget Sound. And there's a lot of really nice beaches, a lot of really nice sea run cutthroat and coho salmon fishing up there on that coast.
Okay. And are cutthroats, we had a question in from Harold Sinclair in New York. He was said he caught sea run cutthroats in on the Trask and Wilson Rivers in Oregon this March while steelhead fishing. But he wanted to know if they could find them in the northeast of the United States. Are there any cutthroats on the East Coast, or is it strictly a northwest?
No, cutthroat are sort of a western trout, and they're sort of related to rainbow trout. They have a common ancestor, and they can have fertile offspring. But cutthroat are sort of our brook trout, and the northeast doesn't really have any cutthroat trout that I know of. I do know that there are sea trout in the northeast, particularly brook trout that go out to the ocean. They're called coasters. And I think there's also a few brown trout that go out to the ocean, into the Atlantic Ocean. But cutthroat, and there are a lot of different subspecies of cutthroat, are mostly a West Coast fish. And sea run cutthroat are almost exclusively found from, say, Northern California up the West Coast, up through British Columbia to Alaska.
Okay. Now, we did a show last week on the Great Lakes, and we were talking about steelhead in the Great Lakes and how they were brought from your area up there in the Great Lakes.
Correct.
To start the steelhead. But evidently they didn't bring any cutthroat with them at the same time. now, you know, I go figure, but maybe because, is it because rainbows just steelhead get larger or more of a sport?
Steelhead get larger, they do. There in Lake Washington, which is a big freshwater lake right in the middle of Seattle, there are sea run cutthroat that live in Lake Washington, or coastal cutthroat we also call them. And they get big, you know, there's 7, 8, 9 pound fish in there, which is getting to be steelhead size. There's no 20 pounders in there. But whenever you put a trout in a freshwater environment, just packed full of food and no current to fight, they get big. I'm not sure why they didn't bring cutthroat to the Great Lakes. Cutthroat are sort of an interesting fish because they're not very, for years they weren't considered very glamorous. They're considered a breakfast fish. You know, you catch a cutthroat and you throw them in the pan for breakfast while you're fishing for steelhead or salmon. And even now, most of the Northwest is fairly well obsessed with steelhead and salmon, and cutthroat are sort of, they fly under the radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, there's actually several types of cutthroats in the Pacific Northwest. Can you kind of tell us about those and break those down for us?
Sure.
I guess I meant by where they live, kind of, you know.
Okay. Well, there's right. You can find sea run cutthroat and non-sea run cutthroat in the same river, and the easiest way to find them is in the lower part of a river that touches salt water and has salmon. There will be sea run cutthroats. If you come across, however, impassable falls, upstream of that falls, you will find cutthroat trout that have never been to the ocean or salt water because they can't get to it. You know, their offspring coming back upstream can't jump over the falls. And so these are resident, all freshwater cutthroat trout. And they look very different from a sea run cutthroat trout. A sea run cutthroat trout in saltwater looks a lot like a steelhead or a salmon. It's usually very silvery. It's sort of got an olivish, greenish back that fades to blue, lots of black spots. They're usually very bright, silvery fish. If you find a river fish upstream of a waterfall, you'll see a fish that's sort of buttery yellow, with yellowish fins, lots of black spots. They'll look a lot like a rainbow trout, especially until you look at the cutthroat mark underneath their jaw, and then you'll realize you've caught a little cutthroat trout. There are also cutthroat trout that live in freshwater all the time, and they're in lakes and streams and everything like that. There's Bonneville cutthroat, which are like a desert cutthroat. There are Yellowstone cutthroat, which live in Yellowstone National Park and Yellowstone Lake, and that sort of acts like a big ocean for them, or a little ocean for them, rather. So cutthroat can live just about any place where there's food and clean water and cold water, but the access to the stream, to salt water is what makes a cutthroat a sea run cutthroat, and they have to go out and get it going to salt water to become a sea run cutthroat.
So if a cutthroat is living in a stream or river that has access to salt water, do they all become sea run cutthroat, or is it just ones with certain DNA that go to sea?
Well, from what I understand, from what the biologists tell me, and just even now, sea run cutthroat are being studied in a serious way. For a long time, they like I said, flew under the radar. From what biologists can tell is that some cutthroat decide to stay in freshwater all the time, and a lot of them decide to go down to saltwater. And no one's really quite sure why. I guess it could be a DNA thing or something like that. But if you're fishing in Puget Sound and you're fishing a small creek in Puget Sound or even a larger river like the Nisqually River or the Skagit River or anything like that. And you'll catch cutthroat trout that are clearly have not been in saltwater, or they have not been in saltwater in a long time. They look more like a, you know, like a regular river rainbow trout as compared to a real silvery bright sea run cutthroat.
So it's just no one knows. It's I think rainbows do the same thing, right? Where they don't all go.
Well, yeah, a sea run rainbow is the steelhead. So
right.
You can, I fish the Deschutes River in Oregon a lot, which through the Columbia River eventually flows to the Pacific Ocean. And there are lots of fully resident rainbow trout in the Deschutes, and there are some of them become steelhead and some of them don't.
They don't get the call, huh?
I guess not. Maybe the full moon has to hit them at a certain angle or something like that. I'm not sure.
Go figure nature, huh?
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the life cycle of the sea run and, you know, what it goes through in the years at sea and the years of freshwater, that kind of thing.
Well, a sea run cutthroat in Washington or Puget Sound, there are no hatcheries for them. There are no sea run cutthroat hatcheries. So if you catch a sea run cutthroat in the west coast of the United States, it was born in a stream. And what happens is that cutthroat will run upstream in the wintertime when the streams are sort of filled up with water. And they'll zip up there starting around January or so and into February and March and even April, spawn very quickly, make a red way up in the headwaters above where the salmon spawn. These are what we call jump across creeks. You can walk, basically step across them. Mm-hmm. After they spawn, these sea run cutthroats shoot back down to saltwater as fast as they can. And sometimes you'll catch them in late winter. They're sort of skinny, skinny fish. Big heads, look really hungry. They're eating anything that they can see. Cutthroats don't die after they spawn, although some of them do, but they're not like salmon. They don't all die. So these eggs sit in the gravel, and eventually the little fish hatch out, and they usually live in the stream till they get to be about 6 inches or so. And that's when they seem to make a decision, and this takes like a year, year and a half. They make a decision on whether they're going to go into saltwater. And you'll see them when the new smolting cutthroat go into the water. You'll see lots of them. You'll see lots of them along the beach. And if I start hooking them, I usually go to a different spot because they sort of school up together. They're very aggressive, very hungry fish. And in Puget Sound, they stay in salt water most of their lives. They grow pretty fast. There's a lot of rich things for them to eat. But their growth is limited because a lot of biologists tell me that it's a lot of work for their metabolisms to keep the fish processing things in salt water. They have to spend extra energy metabolizing food. And, so, you know, it just takes more energy to live in salt water than it does in fresh water. But there's a lot of food there. So they'll be in salt water for a couple, 3 years, and then they decide they want to have babies too. And lots of times you'll see sea run cutthroat go up into a river for no discernible reason. They don't run up like in scheduled things like salmon do. You know, when you have a run of Chinook salmon in Puget Sound or on the west coast of the United States, they all come up, you know, in this big slug of fish most of the time, you know,
right.
Or a certain time of year that's really predictable. You can find sea run cutthroat running up a river in the middle of summertime when there's not a salmon in the river and it's not time to spawn, and they're just up there to eat. You know, they might be rising on dry flies just like a brown trout, or, you know, they're just there and no one's sure why they do this. But it's very sure that they will be going up and following salmon runs because they like to eat salmon eggs. And they also like to eat when the salmon die and begin to decay. They eat the salmon too. It's kind of like rainbow trout fishing in Alaska. It's the same thing.
Sure.
They eat the eggs, they eat the flesh, the same thing. So anyway, the easiest way to find them is when the salmon are running into the rivers, the sea run cutthroat will be just below them, and you can fish egg flies for them and catch them. They will, again in the fall, they'll run up. They'll eat salmon, eggs, and flesh all winter long if they're allowed to. In northern Puget Sound, where there are big rivers, most sea run cutthroat in that part of Puget Sound spend their winters in the big rivers, because there's a lot of food there. In South Puget Sound, which is mostly a place of small rivers, the cutthroat spend most of the winter in the saltwater. So South Puget Sound, which I would define as like Olympia and Hood Canal, north to a line about where the Tacoma Narrows Bridge is, that's territory for sea run cutthroat just about year-round. In the north part of the sound, you'll find sea run cutthroat in saltwater from early spring through late fall. So anyway, and then that sort of completes the cycle. You know, they lay eggs and shoot off, and then hopefully a lot of babies come out of the gravel.
So the spawning months are what again?
Well, they're usually, once again, these fish are hard to define. I've seen them spawning in January, and I've seen them spawning in, you know, early May. They're a very plastic fish, and they react to conditions, not to like a set time clock.
Right, right. But basically,
but the vast majority of them, January, March, April is their primary spawning time.
And now, do they go up in any kind of school formation, or are they all solitary individuals?
You'll see them in little bunches, in little clumps, like two or three fish, three or four fish. But you don't see a big, like, you know, slug, like a big pod of fish going upstream like you would, you know, a coho salmon or a Chinook salmon or a chum salmon or pink salmon. And they go as far up as they can and still keep their backs wet. They spawn well up so their young don't have to compete with really aggressive coho and Chinook salmon fry, which are really aggressive fish and will take over a pool very quickly.
Okay. Well, Chester, we need to take a quick break, but we'll come back and talk more about these sea run cutthroat trout. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view their fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Chester Allen about fly fishing for sea run cutthroat trout. If you'd like to ask Chester a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Chester, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, so what have you been up to?
Well, I've been fishing a lot in Puget Sound. This is a good time of the year to fish for sea run cutthroat in Puget Sound because chum salmon, there's a lot of chum salmon that return to Puget Sound every year, and they have millions of babies. And these fish, unlike other salmon, chum and pink salmon, they're young. Go down to salt water almost immediately after hatching out of the gravel. And the cutthroat know this, and they patrol the beaches, and they intercept these schools of 2-inch to 3-inch chum salmon, young chum salmon, and just wallop them. And you fish streamer flies and catch a lot of big, big cutthroat trout. It's a lot of fun. I've also been fishing the Deschutes in Oregon a lot. Blue-winged olive hatches this time of year. Been fishing the Crooked in Oregon a lot. Just trying to keep my line wet.
That's always a good thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you want to say anything about the book you're working on?
The book I'm working on doesn't have a title yet. But the idea behind the book is that throughout, you know, as fly fishermen, we all travel like crazy, and we travel all around the world if we can. And what I've noticed in about 40 years of fly fishing, that I learn different things in different places, and the things I learn in those places often translates really well to fishing that I do closer to home. So, for example, if you go to the Henry's Fork River at Railroad Ranch near Last Chance, Idaho, which is a really tough river to fish, really picky rainbow trout, if you want to hook those fish, you better know how to do a downstream reach cast, because if you cast over them, they spook. And so you go there and you learn very quickly how to do this cast if you want to catch these fish. And I came home from fishing that river the first time many, many years ago, and I started using a downstream reach cast on some tougher fish and back eddies on the Deschutes River. And it worked really well. So I thought, So ever since then, whenever I've traveled any place, I've kept pretty careful notes on what I've learned at each place that I've visited and how it sort of relates to my fishing closer to home. So the book is sort of a travelogue. You know, I'll take people to Yellowstone and different parts of the Northwest, a couple places in Mexico, a little bit of Alaska, and I'll talk about the joys of going to these different spots and then what these fish at different spots have taught me over the years.
Yeah, and putting that into a collection. I'm not sure if we just got broken up there by incoming Skype call. Did you sound at all folks out there, just let me know if you heard what Chester just said. If you can type in and let me know if you heard clearly what he just said, because I was on another computer up here. A Skype call was coming in, and all I was hearing was Chester underwater. So,
oh, that can't be good.
So I just want to check. It was just that last part about your book, but I want to make sure people got it just fine. Okay, good. Thanks, folks. Yeah, so they heard you. It was just my end of it that was had you underwater. So.
Oh, okay, that's good to hear.
Okay, good. So any time frame on getting the book out, or is it just
I'm not sure. I'm just about finished writing it, and I'm sort of polishing things up, and I have to start sending things into my editors at Stackpole, which is a really terrific company to work with, and for Jay Nichols and Amy Lerner are my editors there, and they're just really fantastic people to work with. I'm an editor and writer in my full-time life, and I know how hard the job is that they have, and they perform it with a lot of grace and a lot of joy.
Well, good. And you want to tell people about your blog? Because I'm sure you post some adventures.
Yes. I have a blog. It's called Chester Allen's Watery Planet. And I started writing this a long time ago. And it sort of started out as just, you know, I was writing a twice-a-week outdoor column for a newspaper at the time. And there was other things I wanted to write that there wasn't really room for in the newspaper. So I just started jotting things into it. Anyway, it's called Chester Allen's Watery Planet. And the address is www.watermagic.typepad.com. Well, it's a lot of characters. It's watermagic.typepad.com. If you Google Chester Allen, you'll immediately come across it. I have sort of a weird name, so it's I have great rankings on Google because there aren't many Chesters out there.
Yeah, and we also looks like we've got that link to that posted on your speakers page on Ask About Fly Fishing, mm-hmm. so people can get it there too and get connected with you. Good. Well, thanks for sharing what was going on in your fly fishing world lately, and sounds like you're getting your share of the fishing in. That's good. That's important.
That's been a goal for a long time.
Yeah. Yes. Since you were a kid. Yeah. Question, this is an interesting question, and I don't know if this relates at all or if you can shed any light on this, but Steve Goodchild in the UK, Northumberland, and he says, I fish a river in the northeast of the UK called the River Tyne. It is well known for salmon and sea trout runs, but unfortunately my stretch of the river is challenging. I have been informed that the salmon/sea trout run different sides of the river at different times of the year or at different water levels. Is this true, and why? Any advice? Have you experienced any of that in the Northwest?
Yes and no. I mean, I know when Mr. Goodchild was talking about sea run, the sea trout, and that's what in the United Kingdom they call it, that's the sea run brown trout. And I know this because my mother was English and I've spent some time fishing there and goofing around in that wonderful country. So they have sea run brown trout and then they have regular Atlantic salmon. Here in the Northwest, there's a very close relationship between cutthroat trout and salmon. When the salmon are in the river, the cutthroat trout are following the salmon right into the river because they want to eat their eggs, and later on they want to eat them, you know, the decaying bodies, which sounds kind of gross, but it's actually kind of cool if you watch it. So in the Northwest, if you want to catch sea-run cutthroat trout when there are salmon in the rivers, it's actually some of the easiest fishing you'll ever have. You kind of creep along the stream trying to not spook any fish, especially the salmon, because if you spook salmon, they'll cause a big ruckus and they'll look like there's a riot going on in the water. And you don't cast to the salmon. You look just below the salmon. And what I try and do is find the first little slot of deep water below spawning salmon. And then I have a little egg fly, maybe with a little split shot or not, on my fly line. And I cast up in the shallow water, and I just let that egg fly drop down into the little dark slot. And if the cuts are there, you'll see some flashes in the water. It'll look like miniature camera flashes are going off. And those are sea run cutthroat trout fighting over your fly. And when I see those flashes, I just lift my rod tip, and more often than not, I've hooked a sea-run cutthroat trout.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fascinating how close these cutthroat trout will. They will actually swim into a salmon red and steal eggs. They get really bold. There's a lot of free dumb protein out there, and they're eating it like crazy. So that's what happens in the Northwest. I'm not sure if that happens in English salmon rivers. I couldn't say, you know, with accuracy, that's what goes on. I know that this is a similar thing in Alaska with rainbow trout and salmon and also sea-run cutthroat. in some parts of coastal Alaska. So my guess was that I think there's probably a relationship because I know brown trout eat when they come back into freshwater. And if salmon are spawning, I'm sure they're trying to get eggs. So I would try an egg fly and just see what happens.
We were up on a tributary up there called Cache Creek in Alaska, and we were fishing for Dolly Varden. And mm-hmm. It was the same situation, and they were behind the kings. We were up there mm-hmm. during silver, you know, in August, but there were still kings in these side creeks just sitting on the reds and dying. But mm-hmm. So we had to do just what you said. You know, we were trying to float, you know, just on top of the kings and into the dollies, which are right behind them, just as you described it. And but the problem was, is every once in a while, you just kind of foul hook a king. And it wasn't a good yeah. situation because we were fishing with trout gear. Uh-huh. You know, we were looking for big trout, but not a 40-pound, you know, pissed king on there.
Block is nice.
So as soon as we and they're, you know, they weren't. I mean, they were, you know, kind of half dead, but they were still 40 pounds. You know, it's like,
yeah, right.
So as soon
right.
as we hook them, we like, you know, and then you just quickly snap off, you know, before they got mm-hmm. took your gear downriver. But it was the same situation. They just hang right behind them and chow down like a conveyor belt, I guess.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's why I always try and go a little below.
Yeah.
I try and go a little further downstream. Yeah, sometimes they get really tight. They get bold, and they're almost eating them as they come out of the salmon. It's pretty
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, well, fresh sushi.
Yeah, exactly.
Grow. So you kind of told us this, but just to be clear about it, and I think you said it that just kind of depends on where you are up there in Washington area. But are the cutthroats then are available pretty much all four seasons? And if
They are. Even if you're fishing an Oregon coastal river for during salmon time, like Mr. Sinclair from New York did, you'll catch sea run cutthroat in the river then. So that's, you know, sea run cutthroat time. Basically, in the Northwest, if you're fishing in a river and there's salmon in the river, it's also a good time to fish for sea run cutthroat, as long as it's legal. Whether, you know, in some bodies of water, it's illegal to fish for trout during salmon season, et cetera, especially in some rivers in Oregon where they're trying to manage things in a certain way. In Puget Sound and Hood Canal and the Olympic Peninsula, the saltwater sea-run cutthroat fishing is almost a year-round thing. If you get into North Puget Sound, like North Puget Sound up into British Columbia, it's more of a spring, summer, fall thing. But I know that a lot of people catch really nice sea run cutthroat throughout the year in South Puget Sound because I was one of them. And that's one of the reasons why it's such a great place to be, because the cuts are almost always in saltwater. They're almost always available. It's almost a year-round fishery. The only time it's not really great is if we've had a lot of rain and the rivers blow out and they're pouring a lot of mud into Puget Sound and then everything just turns off.
Yeah. Expect that. So is there, you know, if a person was coming all the way from the East Coast or something to try their hand at sea run cutthroat, what time of year would you consider the best time of year for someone to come out?
I think this time of year is there's two great times to me. This time of year from March through early June is when we have a lot of baby chum salmon running along the beaches. The trout are very aggressive. They're in great shape. They're chasing these little cutthroat fry, chum salmon fry, and it's kind of like fishing a salmon fly hatch on the Deschutes River or the Madison River in Montana. The fish are up and at these things, and they're really aggressive. The second really good time of year to me, if you're in saltwater, is in the fall, and then the fish are sort of eating a smorgasbord of sand lance, which is a long, skinny fish that looks like an eel. They're eating crustaceans. They're eating sculpins. They're eating just about anything they can cram into their mouths. And that fishing usually starts around, depending on the weather, things start cooling off around the middle of September, and it lasts through Thanksgiving in Puget Sound. If you're fishing the rivers, when salmon start returning to the rivers and getting ready to spawn, that is another excellent time to be freshwater fishing for sea run cutthroat. And that's how most people get introduced to sea run cutthroat in the Northwest. They're fishing salmon, and they catch a sea run cutthroat, and they go, wow, I didn't know these fish were even here. and a lot of people will start to focus on these fish. In Oregon, they call them bluebacks. And so if one of the signals for good freshwater sea run cutthroat fishing is in the fall when you have a lot of salmon in the river. But these cuts will be in the river whenever they feel like it. You'll see them in the middle of summertime sipping dry flies. So the key thing is to be out on the water. And the fish will show you where they are.
Well, we're gonna talk more about this, I think, in a few minutes here when we talk about beaches and so forth. So I'll just hold that question for a second. Let's see what we got. Just checking on the internet for some questions. We have one here about that involves fishing from a kayak. So we'll get to that here in a minute. So what about equipment? Size, weight, rod you recommend for whether it be in stream or in the sound?
In the sound, I really like a 6-weight rod with some backbone to it. And I like a 6-weight because it's not too heavy. And if you're fishing an 8-weight rod, like if you're fishing for coho and you catch a 10-inch cutthroat, the battle is not going to be very, very exciting. But a 6-weight rod is a good rod with backbone. You can cast it in the wind. There are a lot of different lines made for a 6-weight rod. It's just, to me, it's the perfect balance. If you own a 5 or 6-weight rod, you already have a rod that'll work just fine for sea run cutthroat and Puget Sound or, you know, up on the straits or off of Hood Canal.
Now, what, you know, I didn't ask you before, but what's the average size of a sea run cutthroat?
Well, it's been going up. There are more of them, and I'm talking about Puget Sound.
Right.
In Puget Sound, it's been going up. So I would say the average size of the fish I've been catching right now is like 12 to 13 inches, but it is not hard to find an 18-inch fish these days. And an 18-inch sea run cutthroat will make you make you feel a little dizzy because they hit like a freight train. They fight very hard. They're beautiful, chunky, you know, saltwater fish. They're like a miniature steelhead or like a half-pounder steelhead out of the Rogue River.
So, yeah, well, always, you know, if anything that goes to salt or lives in salt, I think tends to be a stronger fish in general. You know,
well, they get supercharged out there. So you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you know, it's eat or be eaten out there, and better be fast and you know, quick about you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, exactly.
What about lines? What do you have with you when you go?
Well, I think actually lines are more important than rods, and this is why I carry three lines. I carry a regular weight forward floater. I carry a clear intermediate line, like what some people call a slime line. And I don't carry a sink tip, but I carry the fastest sinking, full sinking line that I can find and cast on my rod. And this is why. I use the floating line about 10% of the time, and I use that when the fish are very shallow, or I use it when I'm fishing a Miyawaki popper, which is a fly, it looks like a streamer fly. It has a foam head that my friend Leland Miyawaki designed. He's a fishing manager, or was a fishing manager for the Orvis Bellevue store, and is very well known in sea run cutthroat fishing circles. And you let this fly sort of swing in the tidal current, and you sort of tug it a little bit, and it kind of burbles on the surface, and sea run cutthroat come up and wallop this thing. It's a lot of fun. So that's what I save my floating line for. About 60% of the time I use a clear intermediate, which goes just beneath the surface. And I like this line because Puget Sound, you're always fishing for sea run cutthroat when the tidal current is moving. So it's kind of like you're fishing in what looks like a lake, but it's got current like a river. And that intermediate line gets a little bit below the surface, so you have a better connection to your fly. I think the clear intermediate is a little less spooky to the fish. It's easy to cast, and it gives you a good immediate connection to what's going on at the end of your line. Now, the most important line, though, I think, is a full sinking line. And a lot of people don't realize this. I use it, maybe 30% of the time, but I catch most of my biggest fish on this, and this is why. Puget Sound, it gets rained on most of the year, and these fish are used to living under a cloudy sky. And if we get a rare day of sun, well, this time of year we get a lot of sun, but when the sun comes out, these fish are much more reluctant to come up and whack a fly close to the surface. So you got to go down to them. And a fast sinking line is the best way to get anywhere from 4 to 6 feet below the surface and show your fly to a fish that doesn't want to take its tail off the bottom. This is especially important because when you're fishing in a tidal current, so these inlets or beaches, there's a current that runs along them, and it's like a river current. It you can definitely see it. If you throw a tennis ball in the water, you see the ball going down in the current or up in the current, depending whether it's an incoming or outgoing tide. And sometimes you need a sinking line to get down in that current to where the fish are. And even if the bottom is 5 feet deep and that's where the fish are, you only have, you know, maybe 10 seconds or so for that line to really get down in that flowing water to where the fish are, to where you're showing your fly to the fish. And the key in sea run cutthroat fishing is really getting your fly in front of the fish. If they don't want to come up and chase your fly, you have to go down to them, or it's going to be a very long, frustrating day. So I carry three lines, and I care much more about my lines than I do almost anything else, because I know that's what's going to connect me to the fish.
And just to give credit, Dino in Marysville, Washington, had asked about your lines, but he also asked about leader and tippet. So it sounds like you're spending quite a bit of time underwater. So do you go with a shorter leader and tippet then?
When I'm fishing a full sinking line, I just use a straight, you know, bit of tippet tied to the end of my line. I don't taper it at all. And okay. If it's this time of year and I'm fishing streamer flies, like a Chum Baby, Bob Triggs, who's a guide up on the Olympic Peninsula, developed this wonderful fly called a Chum Baby, and it imitates a chum fry very well. And so I'll use like a 4 foot length of 1X tippet as my leader, and that's fine. A long leader with a sinking fly line sort of defeats the purpose, because a long leader will let the fly ride well above the line, and you want that fly down. So it's okay to run a short, pretty hefty leader when you're doing that. I will fish a full 9 foot leader with sometimes a 2 or 3 foot tippet if I'm fishing up towards the surface and the fish are eating small crustaceans or eusophids, which is like a small krill-like crustacean, or baby shrimp or anything like that they're eating up near the top. I will fish, you know, I don't like to go any lower than 4X, because I like to hook these fish and I like to get them in fast. I don't like to play them for a long time. But I will go down to, you know, as low as 4X if the bugs are small.
Okay. And, need to take a quick break. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay. Take a quick break then, and then we'll come back and talk more about food and flies here. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. To learn more about fly fishing for women, go to www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Chester Allen about fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout. If you'd like to ask Chester a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Chester, let's talk about food and flies. Now, you've so far mentioned quite a few food sources. Are there others that need to be mentioned as far as major food sources that the sea run cuts like?
I kind of go into this in pretty exhaustive detail in my book, but generally speaking, sea run cutthroat eat small minnows. They eat sculpins in both fresh and saltwater. They eat, in freshwater, they eat everything like a freshwater trout would eat. You know, they eat mayfly nymphs, caddisfly nymphs, you know, stuff like that, dry flies. In Puget Sound and other saltwater bay areas, they will eat small shrimp. But pretty much anything that's in the drip, they'll eat eusophids and other little creatures that are, you know, what basically make up krill. They're very opportunistic, and they'll eat anything that they can sort of fit into their mouths. There's seasons for these different foods. In winter, I fish a lot of sculpin patterns. Small sculpin patterns, usually like a good muddler minnow, works just fine. And they don't have to be huge. And we're talking about, you know, one that's, you know, maybe an inch and a half long. And you see them all over saltwater beaches on Puget Sound. Then come chum fry, which are small streamers, they imitate chum salmon fry. A woolly bugger is an excellent fly to imitate, you know, a variety of things. I let the fish decide what they want it to be, and then they eat it. a really good fly strip a woolly bugger through the water, and it says, what does it look like? It looks like everything. And these fishes are, something that's
tasty. Why it works so well anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. I think I've caught, I've caught tuna on woolly buggers. So they're just an amazing fly. A small scud fly, like a true bud scud or, like you would see using a freshwater stream, is an excellent pattern to use when fish are eating krill, little shrimp and krill and stuff like that. In Puget Sound, we kind of boil it down to, size and color and shape, match it by that when it comes to those little crustaceans. Later in the year is sand lance, which is a long kind of skinny eel-like fish. And that's like an extra long streamer fly. And then, you get into the fall and, they're eating just about everything that's swimming around. Small anchovies, small herring, small, bright, shiny flies work really well. And it's not complicated. You don't have to really, it helps to match it as closely as you can. But, these fish are pretty aggressive.
And it helps to know what's going on in that particular season. Like you say, if the chum fry are working, then you'd probably be working a lot of streamers.
Mm-hmm.
Go with the flow.
I guess this is the point where I pimp my book a little bit, because my book goes into pretty exhaustive detail about what to expect when you're out there on this, and it gives you sort of a timetable and a selection of flies to bring along, and that'll keep you in pretty good shape.
Yeah, yeah. How long is that sand lance? I see the picture of it here.
Well, you can see small ones that are, they get longer as the year goes on. The longest ones that I usually fish are about 6 inches long, and that would be a really long one. Most of mine are like 4 inches long, or for the longest, or 3 inches long. They're an interesting fly.
I was going to say, it looks like it's tied really sparsely, though. So it's not a.
I tie all my flies really sparsely. A really heavily tied fly looks very alien, and doesn't look lively. A lot of these creatures in saltwater, they sort of have almost an ephemeral look about them. You can almost see through them. And they tend to zip around, and they tend to flit around, and it's a lot about reflection. And a big bulky fly, I've seen fish spook off big bulky flies, and most beginners fish way too big of a fly and way too heavily dressed of a fly.
Okay, good tip. Good tip, yeah. So if there were, if you were to pick kind of the four seasons, would you have particular go-to flies for each of those seasons?
My go-to flies that I would always carry, I would have like a size 10 3XL long woolly bugger in olive, and I would also have it in black, and I would have it in red. I would have a no-hackle woolly bugger in red and black, with black being the tail and the head, because it imitates a pretty prevalent marine worm. These fish eat marine worms all the time, and a woolly bugger does a really good job of imitating those. I would have a selection of scud flies tied with hare's ear rabbit fur in sizes 14 to 8, with a big emphasis on 14 and maybe even 16. I'd have that same fly tied with white dubbing. I'd have that same fly tied with pink dubbing. I have that same fly tied with olive dubbing. I've had some sculpin patterns, and a mother minnow works just fine, and I like it better than some others that I've seen. I, again, have the sand lance fly. Long silvery streamer flies are a really good thing to have. I would have some big dry flies. They're called stimulators. They look sort of like a great big elk or caddis. And in Puget Sound in the fall, we get a lot of termites flying in the air, and they land on the water, even in saltwater, and the fish go nuts. And I carry those just in case. And they're fun to cast, because they sort of skip along the surface. They're almost like a waking dry fly for steelhead. You'll have this color of this V of coming out from behind the fly, exactly what you don't want to see if you're fishing a dry fly for rainbow trout in a river. The fish won't eat a dragging fly, but cutthroat will eat a dragging fly when there's a lot of termites on the water. Basically, small little crustacean-y things and fishy-looking things and sculpin-y-looking things, and that's pretty much what you need.
Okay. Scott Nelson in Portland, Oregon, wanted to know about whether cutthroats still feed once they enter the fresh water. What styles of, wants to know what you recommend, but if they're feeding, do they feed when they come in out of the salt, or are they?
Sure, sure. We've talked about that a lot. You know, they come in and they eat the salmon eggs, they eat the dead salmon. So from if I'm fishing a freshwater stream, any place in Huron cutthroat country, from anywhere from fall through winter, through spring, I'll bring flesh flies, which are, you know, like little, like marabou things that look like a chunk of salmon flesh going down the river, like in peach or a whitish color. I would bring a lot of egg flies. I would bring the regular assortment of nymphs that you would, you know, caddisfly nymphs, minifly nymphs. I would bring dry flies, blue-winged dollar flies, elk hair caddis, ex-caddis. And you might use any or all of these things because they're going to be eating. You can find sea run cutthroat in, like, the Wilson or Trask rivers here in northern, you know, in western Oregon, or little creeks that flow into the Pacific Ocean. And these fish will come right out of salt water, and they'll be eating a midge-hatch. So once they get in fresh water, they act like a rainbow trout a lot. Sometimes you'll find them, a lot of them, in sort of slack water, like back eddies and deep spots near the bank, and some people will throw streamers at them then, and that's a good way to catch them. Some people throw a fly called a Knudsen spider, which is like a big soft tackle, and they really like that fly in both fresh and salt water. So these fish will, they eat quite a lot. I've never seen them not want to eat. I don't fish on them when they're spawning. I can't say about what they're doing when they're spawning, but every other time they're happy to eat.
I guess what people are thinking is that, you know, they kind of think maybe they're more like steelhead, where steelhead may not, you know, actually be on the feed because they've got other things on their mind, you know, when they're running up river.
Yeah.
But the cutthroat, it's just another piece of water as far as they're concerned, it sounds like. So unless they're spawning, then they're on the feed, which is, you know, 90% of the year, right? And it's
yeah,
just
the cutthroat are interesting. Yeah, the cutthroat are interesting because they don't follow the rules that we think,
right.
You know, they don't act like salmon and they don't always act like trout. And, you know, with steelhead, we expect to see steelhead in the rivers. You know, if it's a summer steelhead, we expect to start seeing them, you know, in the rivers in late summer. If it's a winter steelhead, we expect them to be in the rivers, you know, starting in Thanksgiving. But cutthroat go in whenever they feel like it. You know, some days you go, to, you know, one day you might be on the river and you don't see one sea run cutthroat, and you'd be there 3 days later and maybe you got a little bit of rain. And there's sea run cutthroat everywhere. So they just do what they want.
A couple more questions about flies. Jim Wright in Crescent City, California, want to know if you use any searching patterns if you're checking out a new area. So do you prefer that time before or after high tide? So we're starting to start talking about tides here, which I know is real important here. But I guess his main part of the question is, do you have searching patterns, or are you fished it so much now that you're pretty dialed in to know what's happening out there?
I have two major searching patterns. One is a woolly bugger, and the other is a Knudsen spider. If I'm in salt water, I pretty much know what kind of food's going to be around. But sometimes a searching pattern will outfish an imitative pattern, and I can't tell you why that they will. Cuts like to have a fly that has lots of movement to it and looks alive. So, I use those searching patterns a lot. And I guess Jim wanted to know whether I like the time before or after a high tide. When you're fishing a beach, we as humans, we really want it. Like, we want to say, okay, well, it always works best this way. But every beach fishes differently because it has different topography underneath the water. And the topography always changes because the tide is moving in or out. And when you're fishing sea run cutthroat trout in salt water, you really want to be there when the tidal current is moving. So you're either fishing an ebb tide, which is or outgoing tide, which is the water's going down, or you're fishing a flood or incoming tide where the water's going up. So what you want to do is you want to be there when the water's moving. You don't want to be there at slack tide when the water is sort of still and stagnant. The fish seem to really go off the bite most of the time. I would say, like, I know there are times when I've caught fish, and my friends especially have caught fish during slack tide, but they really like a moving tide because that's when the food is moving. You know, food is getting flushed out and moving down the current. So different beaches fish differently on different tides. Some beaches, because of where they are and whether they have, you know, rocks in a certain position, they fish better on an incoming tide. Some beaches fish better on an outgoing tide. Some fish equally well on both. So the key is you have to learn each beach. And so there's not one, each beach is a different case. And so you have to go and fish it on all stages of the tide, and then you know. So there's a lot of discovery, which is my favorite part of this fishing.
Well, we'll dig into that here and after we take this next break. I'll start talking about strategies and tactics here. So hang with me here, folks, and we'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles, the classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Chester Allen about fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout. If you'd like to ask Chester a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so we're starting to get into a little bit of tactics, talking about the tide changes and so forth. Now, Chester, you usually fish, well, it sounds like you do everything, but, you know, when you're going up to Puget Sound, do you like to focus on the beaches or the mouths of the rivers and kind of stay in the salt, or do you prefer the streams and rivers away from the salt?
I prefer the beaches because there's 2,500 miles of shoreline in Puget Sound if you count Hood Canal. And so, and this is, there's some major, you know, metropolitan areas. There's Tacoma, there's Seattle, Vancouver, BC. But you have so much shoreline that you're never crowded. I mean, I could spend the rest of my life zipping around Puget Sound and I wouldn't touch every bit of beach that I'd want to touch. And learning, you catching the fish in saltwater, which is a kind of a novelty to me still, you know, catching trout swimming around in saltwater to me is just a kick in the pants. And there's just more fish there, and it's just, to me, it's a very interesting fishery. So I would much rather fish them in saltwater than freshwater.
And you've got, tend to have the bigger fish and plus some stronger fish, right? So that's a...
Bigger and stronger fish. Yeah, and you're catching them when they're prime, you know, they've been eating a lot of rich food. They swim hard in these tidal currents, so they're really strong. They're focused on feeding. They're just in beautiful condition. You know, they're shiny and bright, and they have sea lice on them. And it's just an exciting time. It's just an exciting way to catch these fish.
Yeah. Anytime you have, you know, the salmon too. I always like the, you know, when the silvers come out of the sea and they've got the sea lice on them. You feel like, I don't know, you're closer to the source and. You know, uh-huh, an ocean-going uh-huh. fish coming in. But that's a question before we jump into beaches here. When you say they go to sea, are we talking Puget Sound, or do they actually go out into the Pacific, or do they know?
I'm sure some go out into the Pacific, but from what I understood and talked to some really good biologists, most of the time sea-run cutthroat will stay fairly close to the stream they came out of. And I think that sort of bears out in Puget Sound, because Puget Sound is you know, when you look on a map, it looks like a big hand with all these inlets, you know, coming out being the fingers. And there's like sub-inlets to those inlets. And the inlets that have a lot of streams flowing into the sound tend to be better fishing than ones that don't have a lot of fresh water coming in. So I think these fish tend to hang around pretty close to where they come from. But I know they also move a lot, too, because I watch them. And in Puget Sound, you know, you can have a tidal change of 14 feet or more. And that means the water level is going to drop or rise 14 feet in this period of 6 to 8 hours. So if the water level is dropping 14 feet in an inlet over 6 hours, those fish have to move out. They have to swim out of the inlet, or they're going to be high and dry. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be on mud if they don't, you know, swim down the current.
Right.
So they do move around quite a bit. And lots of times I'll fish a really good beach for a couple of days, and I'll come back the third day, and there are no fish on that beach. You know, it's, they're sort of mysterious fish that move around. Yeah, they're
there
somewhere.
Again, they kind of break the rule of what salmon and steelhead do.
They do. They break the rules. They're their own strange cells.
Okay. So how do you find a good beach? What are the characteristics of a good beach for cutthroats?
I kind of go into this in my book a lot, but in short, if the first thing I look for in a beach is I like to see a rocky beach, a muddy beach to me, I catch way more fish off a rocky, pebbly beach. A lot of barnacles, a lot of marine life like oysters or mussels or clams. If I see a lot of shells on the beach, I'm happy. I like to have a beach that has obstructions that create current seams, which we call rips. And a rip in sea run cutthroat lingo is basically that seam, that line between fast and slow water. So if there's a point on the beach or large boulders or oyster bags or oyster beds, as the water level changes, eventually these will become obstructions, just like, you know, a rock in a trout stream. And when you look at a rock in a trout stream, you see the current hits it, and it creates a seam on both sides of the rock. And, you know, if you're fishing any trout stream, you know to fish those seams, and it's the same thing with sea run cutthroat. So I look for structure that can produce seams. I look for, you know, trees overhanging the bank. I look for driftwood logs on the bank. I want my beach to look as natural as possible. The best ones usually have a creek that flows in nearby or there. And then once I find this beach, you know, then I say the work begins, but it's really not work, because then I try and fish it on a full incoming tide, and I try and fish it on a full outgoing tide, and I see how the beach changes as the water level changes. This is no beach. The beach never stays the same for very long, and a beach that is barren of fish, like, say, 1 hour after the tide begins to drop, might fill up with fish 2 hours later because the dropping water has exposed structure that creates rips or current breaks or standing waves, which is something you would see where there's a sudden drop-off. And they might use it during those moments when these things exist, but the water level is continuing to drop or rise, and that structure might vanish, and then the fish will go someplace else. So you really have to fish a beach on both ends of the tide, and then you get kind of an idea where the fish are going to be and when they're going to come sliding in there. It's sort of, each beach is its own puzzle, and some are much better than others, for obvious reasons. And finding a beach and then learning a beach is, to me, is endlessly fascinating. It's what keeps me coming back. It's like a treasure hunt.
Is it something you take notes on? Do you keep a journal or anything about where certain rips are, or structures, and drop-offs and that kind of thing, so that when you come back?
It's crazy enough. So yes.
Hold on, Chester. You're garbling up on me in a second. Okay, why don't you say something now, and let's see what... You there,
something?
Chester?
Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Now you're okay. It was garbling, so I just wanted to make sure that... So go ahead and say about the journaling and so forth.
So, yes, I do keep pretty detailed notes. And what I have is a notebook, and each page is an individual beach, and I'll keep notes on, you know, where I was and where I was catching fish and what it looked like to the tide. It's gotten to the point where I'll go to these beaches on a minus tide, which is where you have a low tide that's much lower than usual, and take pictures of the exposed, you know, underwater topography. So I'll have, you know, in my mind's eye, I'll know that, you know, like, you know, halfway through, if there's like a 10-foot drop of water, I know when it gets 5 foot, when it drops down 5 feet, all of a sudden these oyster bags or this oyster bar is going to be exposed, and it's going to turn into a rip, and that will hold fish. So it's sort of, you have sort of like this, list of beaches that you keep, and you're always monitoring it, and you know, you can't predict with 100% accuracy, but you can get to where you're very confident about which beaches you're going to at a certain day at a certain tide.
And the beaches don't change a whole lot, or do they change? Shifting.
Well, they do change, and that's why you keep going back. You know, there might be trees. A tree has fallen into the water, and it's completely changed. You know, it creates a rip early into the tide, or, you know, Puget Sound grows big trees along these banks. And if, you know, a 100-foot Douglas fir falls, you know, across the beach and into the salt water, it's going to change things.
Or somebody's house.
So, somebody's house, or someone's built a seawall, or someone's built a dock, you know.
Well, so, I mean, yeah, recently you guys made it, I don't know where it was, but, you know, those houses were falling in. I don't know if it was the Sound or what. But
yes, it was. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, that would create quite the rip there.
One of my favorite spots to fish in Puget Sound is a plywood mill had been on the spot, and it burned down in the early 1990s. And then what was left sort of collapsed into Puget Sound. And if you stand on this beach and you look in the water, it looks like someone airlifted a section of Detroit there. There's these steel girders and concrete slabs and all sorts of stuff, and it looks like this post-industrial hell. But when the current goes whipping through there, there's a lot of sea run cutthroat that hang out among all those obstructions. So I fish it, you bet.
Yeah, good, good. So tides are a big deal, and you need to pay attention to those. And those, of course, you know, change time. So do you have tide charts and so forth for the area? Are those readily available?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get tide tables. There's a great website called saltwatertides.com, and it has tide tables for all over the Pacific Northwest and also, you know, the East Coast and everything like that. And I look at that every day, and I can see, you know, you look and say, okay, for example, it'll say like, you know, high tide at 6 o'clock in the morning and it's like 10.4 feet, which means it's, you know, pretty far up the beach. And then it says low tide, you know, 2:30 in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 1.1 feet. So you know that more than 9 feet of water are going to drop off this beach during that tide, during that outgoing tide. So I try and plan it so I'm there for, you know, that time when the water's just receding. The current is flowing. It looks like a river. And I'm pretty sure that sooner or later I'm going to intercept some feeding cutthroat along that beach.
And I suppose that's helpful for people that come from fishing a lot of streams and rivers that aren't familiar with the salt. That gives them some kind of perspective on it, too. Rather than
open
water.
Sure.
Yeah, they know they can know how to fish that. It looks familiar. Thomas Murphy, Redmond, Washington, says, I'm super psyched for this show. So he's right there in the thick of it. So he says he's been out twice on the Puget Sound with Maiwaki poppers, which you just talked about not too long ago. And he says he's been unsuccessful so far. So can you give him some tips on when to use those poppers again and how he might get better action with that or what he should switch to rather than the poppers? He doesn't tell me when he's been out there, so that could be one of the 25 flies you just talked about. But maybe you can just speak to that popper a bit more for him.
Well, the popper is interesting. I know Leland Milwaukee, who's a good friend of mine, he fishes his popper almost all the time. And he catches a lot of fish. One of the things that I think is key is that you have to have fish in the area. If you don't have fish in the area, for whatever reason, you might come across the perfect beach. Everything looks great. There's bait in the water. There's a rip, you know, but there's no trout there. There's no cuts there. And that might have been what happened to Thomas during the couple times he's fished a popper. What I would do if I was Thomas, if he wants to start with a popper and let it swing in the current and let it gurgle it, and if he's not getting fish coming up and whacking at it, even if he's not hooking them, I'll run it through an area like a rip. So if he's fishing it like a seam between fast and slow water that's forming off a point or an oyster bag or anything like that, or fishing it over standing waves, which means there's a drop off there. If he works his way through the area and he doesn't catch any fish, then that's when I would change to a fly that goes underwater. And this time of year I'd put on a Chum Baby fly or one of Doug Rose's Keto Rose flies, which imitate Chum Salmon fly. And I would put on a clear intermediate, and I'd work the same water with that fly underneath the surface. And sometimes I'd let the fly just dead drift in the current. Sometimes I would strip it in slowly, and sometimes I would strip it in as fast as I could move my arms. If that doesn't work, I would then put on my sinking line, put on a short leader, and the same streamer fly or woolly bugger that I was using, or Knudsen spider, and let that thing fish right along the bottom. And that's sort of the progression I do. If I'm on a beach and I think there's fish there and I'm not catching them close to the surface, I work my way down to them. And so I'm talking about, you know, if I don't get a bite in 45 minutes fishing with a popper and I'm not getting any rises to it, that's when I start changing. And if I'll give it that next, I'll give that intermediate line and that fly about 45 minutes, and then I'll go to the sinker, and then I might start all over again. So, and the other key thing to remember is to be patient, because as the water level changes, fish move in and out of these spots. And he may have just had bad luck and not been in the spot when the fish were there. I would try and fish this spot throughout a whole tide and see when the fish show up. And then the next time you might have a better idea when to be there.
Okay. Another question he had was, he said, what are your feelings about how deep a fly should be to be most effective for the sea run? So with your full sinking line, is there kind of a maximum depth you go before you start retrieving?
Sometimes I'll let it, I'll actually cast up current. So, you know, as we're picturing this inlet or as far as Puget Sound where the tidal current is flowing, I'll cast up current just like you would in a river. It gives it extra time to sink. And I'll actually mend line into it, you know, and then it gets right opposite to me. And then I stop mending line and I just, you know, sometimes I'll just dead drift throughout the whole swing. It's like swinging a fly for a steelhead in a river. It's exactly like that. And that gets me as deep as I can get. Sometimes the current is so fast and so powerful that there are times when it's very difficult to get down on the bottom. And that's why I use the fastest sinking line that my rod can handle. And I don't try and use a rod. I don't try and overpower my rod because that's miserable. So I use a sinking line that my rod can handle, and that's really key. It's no fun to overline your rod and have you know, you feel like you're about to break it. So it's sort of being in the right place at the right time. And a lot of this is stuff you learn as you keep fishing these fish. You know, you start to get an intuitive feel about what you should be doing next. And it's not really intuition. It's just that accumulated knowledge in your head that's sort of whispering in your ear.
Yeah. A lot of time on the water, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, when you're used to fishing a particular, when you're used to fishing a particular stream or lake, you know, you can go back there and things would be, you know, fairly much the same. But it sounds like there's so many things that can be changing that you really have to be on top of your game to pay attention to all this stuff. So,
you really do. And all the really good sea run cutthroat fishermen I know are very observant people, and they are not stubborn. They will move. They will change. And there is such a dynamic environment. It's very exciting. It's very exciting.
Dick in Walla Walla wrote in and he says, obtaining permission to fish from a property owner's beach can be difficult, so I've been wondering if fishing from a boat can be an effective way to fish for sea run cutthroats. So can you speak to that about property ownership? Is that an issue?
Yeah, property ownership is an issue. And to tell you the truth, it is sometimes hard to get access to a beach, and there is a lot of privately owned beach in Puget Sound that you can't put your feet on. You can fish it from a boat, no problem, as long as you don't put your feet on the beach. If you are stuck without a boat, I have found that if I go knock on the door and say, look, I just want to fish your beach. If I see any trash, I'll pick it up. I'm not going to keep any fish. It's against the law. You know, I'm not going to tell all my friends to come here. If they say yes, I always stop by again and say thank you. Come Christmas time, I invest in bottles of scotch that get dropped off on doorsteps all over Puget Sound. And because I want these people to be glad to see me. Or if not bottles of scotch, you know, a gift certificate to a restaurant or something like that. It was a little easier for me because I was writing for the newspaper, and so I was a sort of a known quantity. And people
right.
would actually invite me to come fish their beach, you know, in a very friendly way, because when you're writing a newspaper column, people sort of invite you into their house, and you have a conversation with them a couple times a week. So
right.
it was a little easier
right.
for me, but, you know, a lot of it's knocking on doors.
Right.
If you have a boat.
So let's segue into boats and how you fish differently from a boat for the sea run.
This is something I also go into in a lot of detail in my book. If you have a boat, you have the option of fishing every beach. And I fish for them with kayaks with a lot of success. You just have to be careful not to get yourself marooned as the tide goes in or out. I have fished them with motor-powered boats, and I really like that. The key thing is that you need a boat with an anchor that comes off the bow. So when you anchor off a beach, you have your bow pointing into the current, just like you would in a river. And you don't want to fish too far off the beach, but you want to be really sneaky and quiet. And a really effective way of, you know, if you find a beach that's working for you, you can work your way down it or up it, depending on the current, by just lifting and dropping the anchor. And this is something my friend Greg Cloud showed me many years ago. And it's like this dance, you know, you you sort of fished out this spot, and then you want to drop down, like, you know, maybe 100 feet or so and fish another little rip. And he just lifts the anchor and lets the current carry the boat down current, and then when we get to where we want to be, he just drops the anchor again. And so you don't have to start the motor. There's no commotion. And you just sort of ease up on these fish in a really sneaky way. A boat is a very good way to go, except for if you are just learning. If you are just learning to do this kind of fishing, I would recommend you pick out two beaches that you know have cutthroat, and you fish them very hard, and you will learn a lot about where these fish hold, how they behave, and everything like that. The temptation with a boat is to keep zipping around and trying different spots, and you never really learn one beach. You know, the beaches I fish from a boat most of the time are, you know, I sometimes would spend a lot of time just sitting there at anchor watching the water level change. I know this sounds crazy and weird, but that's sort of what you have to do, because you have to know what's going to happen there. And a boat is an awful temptation for people who want to jump on the motor and go away someplace, you know, that might be just as good, and they spend more time driving around than actually fishing.
Right, because you still have the same issues at hand, which is reading the water, knowing the depth of the water during an incoming or outgoing tide, and where to fish it. I know in your book, you know, you have a drawing of a piece of beach and say, yeah, well, here's what it looks like on incoming tide, and here's what it looks like on outgoing tide, and it's like two different fisheries.
They're two different places, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it turns into, so it needs, you know, a whole new analysis that needs to take place, and I can see that from a boat where you're not, you know, probably tending to read the water as well, just because you're in a boat. Yeah. We did get a question in on the internet from Craig in Oregon. He was asking about kayak, whether it makes sense to use a kayak. So he was asking about the Hood Canal and if it was an advantageous way. So you kind of already answered his question on that. So,
absolutely. It's a huge advantage on the Hood Canal, a huge advantage to use a kayak. Yeah.
So there Especially you go, Craig. Go for it.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of does it for us tonight. We're all used up as far as time goes. So, but Chester, stick with me for a little bit longer here because we're going to do some giveaways and give away your book and so forth. So stick with me a few minutes longer and we'll wrap this thing up. We're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, as well as Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea Run Cutthroat Trout, from Stackpole Books. So hang tight here. We'll do that in just a minute. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To visit their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, go to www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners of these drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register yet, it's too late now, but do so for our next show because we're always giving away these great prizes. If you do win, then we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how you're going to get your gift. So first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. It's a great organization to support. You'll want to be a part of that no matter what, so check them out. And our winner there is Sam Brown, and Sam is in Ohio. So, Sam, congratulations on winning that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. I know you'll enjoy it. Our second giveaway is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which is a publication that Amato Books publishes. And our winner there is Michael Willis in Texas. Michael Willis in Texas. So congratulations, Michael, on winning that one-year subscription. If you'd like to find out more about what Amato Books publishes, go to amatobooks.com, and you can see what they have there. Now we'll give away a copy of Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea Run Cutthroat Trout, courtesy of Stackpole Books. You can find Stackpole at www.stackpolebooks.com. And you can also find Chester's book on, of course, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. So now, Chester, what we do is I go online here and I'm going to clear my queue and then ask a question about something we talked about. I've been doing two-part questions here lately just to make it a little harder. but sometimes these fly fishers are so sharp and that they anticipate what fly I'm using before I use it, you know, kind of thing. So so they're pretty sharp. So this is going to be a two-part question for you fly fishers out there. Two things. Give me the name of one of Chester's searching patterns and which kind of line that he likes to use to get to bigger fish. Two-part question.
Good questions. Good questions.
So, again, one of the searching patterns and which type of line he uses to get to bigger fish. So now I'm waiting for them to type. They may be able to type flies on fast, but typing is not one of the things that they can do well. So he's giving them a hard time here. So we're waiting. Come on, you guys, let's go. Somebody's got to have the answer. Okay, here we've got one. Interesting. I don't think this is it, but part one was Woolly Booger. Did you get that,
okay.
That part right? Okay.
That is right.
And in the part two, he put weight forward seven with verse leader tip.
I don't think we brought that up, did we?
No, I didn't. I don't know about that. This one answers muddler and intermediate. That neither of those are correct. So
yeah,
keep guessing. Keep guessing. The book's still available out there. I guess maybe I made it too hard. We'll give it a shot here another time, otherwise we may. So again, you know the first one, which could be is right, is the Woolly Booger, so you just got to get the second part of the line right.
Yeah. There's only,
you know, it's not intermediate, so you got a 50-50 chance here.
Yeah, it's out there waiting for you.
Yeah. Boy, this is the longest we've ever taken. Okay, one of you guys that already answered, you're not going to go for this, huh? Maybe my computer's just slow. Well, they're really slow. Here we go. Got the right answer, only you forgot to put your name on it. So we got Woolly Booger in full sinking line, but whoever sent that in, I have no clue who you are because you didn't put your name on it. So you better put it in again fast, and you'll get yourself a book. Dick. Okay. Would that be Dick in Walla Walla? Let me know, Dick. So I think that's probably who it was, who was the first person that answered.
Okay. You know, if any of your listeners have any additional questions for me, they can contact me through my my blog, and I'll happily answer questions. They send me an email, and I'll answer their questions for them.
There you go, folks. So you've got an opportunity. So if you want to dig deeper with Chester, do two things. Buy his book and then call him. He'll be much more receptive. Or go to his blog.
Those are my favorite people. Those are my favorite people.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dick Fondon in Walla Walla, you are the winner of the book, Chester's book, Fly Fishing for Sea Run Cutthroat Trout. Okay, you guys practice your typing next for the next show because you're really slow this week, so we need to move that along faster. Well, hey, Chester, thanks for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate you being with us. Great show and a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, I had a great time. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Well, folks, on our next broadcast, which will be on May 22nd, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern, on that show, I'm going to interview Tim Lockhart, and our topic for the show will be stillwater strategies. Tim has fished for over 30 years, and over those years, he's developed a practical system for productive fly fishing in still waters. So listen in to learn how to find the best lakes and prime water along with his best presentation strategies. See you on the show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Housatonic Outfitters, Women's Fly Fishing Alaska, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Online Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.